Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We're covering the Constitution, and it's more than a Constitution week. And actually, because of some of the details that we're going to be going through, it'll probably be Constitution Month. And the only reason it's Constitution Month is really more to do to constitutional literacy, because there's just way too many things within the Constitution that we've never taught, that is not being taught in the schools. And when you look at it, it's kind of like looking at the Ten Commandments. And I say this all the time. When you look at the Ten Commandments, you go, okay, I can do that. And you think you understand them, such as thou shalt not commit adultery. Well, okay, that's okay. But you really got to go through the scriptures to understand how adultery is defined, because as Christ said, when a person looks at someone with lust in their heart, they've committed adultery already. And so you just can't extrapolate what thou shalt not commit adultery, you know, and think that you haven't done you've obeyed by the commandments because you haven't done the actual deed. Doesn't mean that you're okay. Doesn't mean you're going to be saved, or I should say, be acknowledged for obeying that commandment, for living the commandments. And so we have to kind of go through what each of these clauses mean in defining what the federal government can do, what they can't do, what are our rights, what aren't our rights. And the First Amendment is really one that has been perverted in so many ways. So we're going to spend a little bit of time, because we were just diving into this, but we're going to spend a lot of time, because there's a lot of details, and we're going to actually go back and forth between the First Amendment and the 14th Amendment. And the reason I'm saying this is because the First Amendment technically is applied by the 14th Amendment to the states, but not all of the First Amendment is applied to the states, not all of it. So this is why it's really important to kind of figure out what are, and we'll get into that. As a matter of fact, I don't want to start having that discussion until I get through the obligatories, because you know we've always got the obligatories. Now, this show is also sponsored by RepublicReview.org. And for those of you that don't know, really quick, RepublicReview.org is not something you can actually go to right now. It is a reserved domain that we have, and we're going to actually give this to the states so that the states will be able to have and utilize this, and they'll be able to create a domain. And hopefully this domain itself will be everything you need to understand what they are doing and how they are doing it in getting prepared to actually force the federal government into compliance. Because I'm telling you, the federal government will not willingly go. As a matter of fact, as we look today at the tyranny, and as we looked over the past 4 years where people really thought Trump was going to downscale the government. No, he really didn't. He didn't. Even Reagan didn't. Do you understand that? Even Reagan did not downscale the government. He may have downscaled some of the, you know, the functions and taxes and the growth of government, but he did not downscale it by getting rid of any offices, departments, or anything like that. And so I was told, oh, no, you know, Trump, he's going to do this. Well, he didn't. Okay, so we now have Biden, who is trying to grow government in lots of ways. And believe me, some of these things have been coming out. And I know that there's lots of things. There's a lot of things in the news cycle that we could start chasing. Do we really want to spend our time chasing things and worrying about things that will not solve the problem? In other words, every time you get caught up in the news cycle, every time that something happens in the news that you want to respond to, then you go, well, I have a choice. I can respond to this brutality. I can respond to this overreach. I can respond to this or that. But what we have to do is we actually have to get our butts organized and start working at the state, working the state towards forcing full compliance. Now, what we need to do, and we're going to get into, and we've talked a lot about this from July up until the Constitution Day, of the importance of public servants supporting the Constitution and how we can start doing this. And I basically told you that that First Amendment petition is a key tool or a key weapon that we can start actually going after these guys. Now, I believe that we have to have this kind of a let's just call it a coin of mercy and justice. And it's, but it's really not a coin. It is basically, let's call it a litmus test. Because if you apply the litmus test on a public servant, the first question should be, did you go, hey, is this even constitutional? Can we even actually do this? And if you're told, because you don't know, but you ask that question by somebody who's actually, you know, trying to push the agenda. Oh, yeah, we can do this, and hoodwinking it and saying, yeah, we can do that. Well, then the person that's challenged it, at least they did some due diligence and, you know, and then put trust in the wrong person. Well, so sometimes we think that, oh, you know, that judge over there, he ought to know. Well, no, they don't. And as a matter of fact, too many judges, too many public servants, because that's all a judge is a public servant. Too many public servants are pushing the agenda and have aggrandized themselves into saying we can do anything that we want to do, and they can't. And so we're here to set the record straight. So on that litmus test, okay, that person should get a first and final. In other words, no, you have to find out for yourself, not from, you know, some source that we can't trust. You actually have to look at the Constitution, and you have to look, and this is why definitizing the Constitution is going to be so important. Because when people go to, you know, the First Amendment, they're going to see this direct link when they look at the First Amendment that, you know, it's at the, like a footnote below it or a little caption above it as a note saying, the First Amendment is also applied to the states. See the 14th Amendment. And then when you go to the 14th Amendment, you'll see which parts of the First Amendment are attached to the states, are now applied to the states. So anyway, you are listening to the only show that's going to go through the academic evidence and the academic evidence-based solutions of what we have to do to actually get the government at all levels, into full compliance of the Constitution. Why is this so important? Because if they are complying, if they're in full compliance of the Constitution, we're not shedding innocent blood. What I mean by that is the federal government is no longer abiding by, you know, this bad ruling from Roe v. Wade that they can actually enforce and pay for abortions. Get them out of the abortion mill business and get them out of actually spending money around the world on abortions. We will no longer be the murderer of the innocent. We will no longer be the tyrant of, you know, helping out these insurance companies and allowing them to make, it's just the same thing with pharmaceuticals. The industrial medical complex that has been created since Eisenhower, well, we can actually shut that down, and we can actually start moving things back towards nonprofit compassionate service organizations such as churches and community services, where it is no longer profit-driven by hiring CEOs to improve operations. I mean, 9 times out of 10, when you hear that, they're, you know, they're making money, they're able to increase their profits. At whose expense? At the customer's expense. And who's the customers? It's you as a patient, where your life is on the line. Oh, well, we cut costs because we didn't give them all the treatment that they could have had. What? That's not a good thing. And so, and it's the same thing with your public utilities. Your public utilities shouldn't be profit-based either. It's what that means is when you hear that your, excuse me, your CEO is of your local electrical company is making millions of dollars, that means that you're paying in your bill for your electricity to pay him those profits and those supposed ways he saved money, and those ways he saved money is by not upgrading the grid, by not doing things to harden it so that we can't be attacked via cyber warfare. I mean, come on, let's wake up. Sometimes the free market is not the proper direction to go. And I'm here to tell you that when it comes to certain things like compassionate services, or what, let's just call them monopolies, because utility services are monopolies. Are you actually going to have multiple water lines coming into your house to say, you know, today, based on the water rate that you're offering, I'm going to use the water from this company instead of that company? It's the same thing with electrical. States can't even afford to allow that to happen because they're the ones that are actually providing all this, because it's, again, public utilities. And so we have to actually, you know, accept reality and say, you know what, we need government to provide certain infrastructure things, but not allowing them to have these profit models and allow these, you know, it's almost like you're paying tax to pay tax. Or when you look at your Social Security tax, that money that you've earned, when you start collecting Social Security, the money that you earned, you know, are actually paid, or the money you've put into Social Security, that came out of money that you earned that you already paid income tax on. Why is it that Social Security taxes are actually taxed? And even though they're unconstitutional, we shouldn't even be doing it. The point is this is how they double taxes. They tax you on your car, selling your car. There's a sales tax. You already paid the sales tax first, the total cost of the car. Anyway, we'll be right back after this.
Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. Okay, so sorry for taking all this time, but it gets under my craw when we start talking about taxes and double taxes and triple. I mean, as we were going into break, I was talking about sales tax on a car. When you go buy that car, you pay the full value sales tax for that item. Now, do you have to pay sales tax on the things that you... I won't say it. Anyway, why is it that certain things, when you sell them, you have to pay a sales tax on them? When those, every single one of those items had a full payment of sales tax on it. It's just another way your state is trying to gouge you for more money. And the question is, why is it that they have such a high demand for more and more money because they're paying for more and more services. It doesn't mean that the cost of roads have gone up. It means that they've moved into doing things in and just got to understand, when you start looking at your state government, it is spending money on roles, responsibilities, and powers that they have no constitutional standing for. Now, they should not have an interface for the federal government on their highway system in the Department of Transportation. The Department of Transportation is unconstitutional. Period. So to have that office, the same thing with the Environmental Protection Agency. The same, and it doesn't mean that your state shouldn't be environmentally wise and having environmental standards and road standards and these other things. It means that you don't have to deal with the bureaucratic cost of doing business with the federal government, which is an unseemly amount of money. In addition, it's the extra services that they want to provide. The fact is the government is very inefficient in providing services, especially when it comes to certain types of services. Now, infrastructure services, they can be pretty efficient. They could be far more efficient than a private agency that is taking millions and millions of dollars out of what we're paying for our electrical bill. If you look at the profits that are coming out of your state in the different electrical companies that you may have, because Washington State has a few different ones. There's Puget Power, there's Inland, there's Avista, and I'm sure there's a couple more. And each of those, well, Inland Power is a co-op, so they're nonprofit-based. But Avista is a profit-based. And I know the CEO for Avista, his annual bonus, I think last year or 2 years ago, when they actually were mentioning it, this guy was making over 20-some million dollars in a bonus on top of his salary. This is a public utility. Isn't there any shame in saying that, you know, we're providing you a service because we're a monopoly and we can walk away from this? This is why public utilities should never have been moved into the private sector. And people say, well, it's profit-based and it's far better. Well, actually, no, it's not. Because how is it that our grid is still completely more vulnerable than it should be? Because it doesn't fit the profit model. If they can just manage for the, if, you know, they're keeping up with the growth, they're keeping up with all these other little things that they have to keep up with. You know, they can't keep up with everything, but they can keep up with the profit-based, you know, stipends, or I should say the, what do they call those, performance bonuses and those types of things? Really? Anyway, we've got a lot of work to do. We've got a lot of cleanup because there's been a lot of, I'll just say, if you want to call them kickbacks, because what do you call that? When you take a public company, you make it private, and all of a sudden these people are making big bucks. And it's no surprise that a lot of these people are huge contributors, like Kaiser. The Kaiser family was a huge contributor to Obama. I mean, when I say a huge contributor, he paid like $75,000 to help Obama's campaign. And he had this company called Solyndra. And Solyndra received, I think it was like almost $1 billion or more. Go look at what Kaiser made in his kickback for his $75,000. Because had, heavens forbid, had John McCain, the communist, actually won that election, then those kickbacks would have gone to a different person, a different group of people who were investors in buying government. And so, you know, unfortunately, this happens because we have such corrupt politicians. We've got to fix this. We literally have to fix this. So anyway, let me finish going through the Timber Nation, timbernation.com if you want hardwood furnishings, radiodustcovers.com if you want to cover your equipment. There is also Ad Local. Go check them out. I'm actually going to talk to, because Mr. Carr in Michigan, that's where Ad Local is located, and they provide And as you know, they'll provide a discount for patriots, but this is where you can get your ISP services for mail and so forth. We're going to have him actually on because we're going to be actually getting engaged with the First Amendment petition process in Michigan. And I've yet to reach out to the Constitution Party and their presence in Michigan, but I think this is an opportunity for them to start becoming the champions in helping educate and helping promote this concept of using First Amendment petitions to get rid of Whitmer, their governor, and all these other bad players in government from their county commissioners up. Anywho, Red Pill Expo. We've got Red Pill Expo coming, and it is a month away. So we need to make sure that we, you know, get our state legislators informed and involved. And so what we want to do is I have to rely on you to get this message out so that your state legislators know these things. And let me just dive into where we left off regarding the Constitution, because we were right there with the Bill of Rights. And so it was actually because we covered the first two amendments, which the second one is actually the 27th Amendment. So we've covered the 27th Amendment. So the next amendment is what we call our First Amendment of the Bill of Rights. Again, there were 12 amendments. The first two were not ratified with the Bill of Rights. And the second one was ratified, but that was ratified in 1992. Are you keeping up? And that first one is actually something that can still be ratified, and it can be the 28th Amendment ratified. And I'm a huge advocate for actually getting that thing ratified, because this would actually displace the House of Representatives, and it would displace the corruption and the swamp and get it back to your states so that they can't hide in D.C. anymore. Your state representatives, I should say, those representatives in Congress would be in your states, and you would have better access to see their shenanigans or anybody. And it actually makes it harder, if you think about it, all the lobbyists that would have to fly to all 50 states to sit down and get enough of these people on board with doing something. This is why we don't even want to have Congress permanently sitting back there. Close down that floor and force everything to start going virtual. That way we can actually have, there'll no longer be a room that they can all walk into without any electronic devices, so nobody can record what they're saying, and have bad, nefarious meetings at the expense of our liberties like they did with Obamacare and other bills. And now force them into these conversations that would be online and on the record. And this is where Intel oversight, you have to have counterintelligence or somebody that would be, and actually, this is where I think the states should start taking, you know, a counter-government type of approach to where they're actually read in to listen to these classified conversations, because the question is, and how many times is it that they're having a classified conversation when technically it is unclassified and it should have been out in the open so that everybody could have heard that conversation? There are way too many. I mean, for decades and decades, as long as classified information has existed and being protected, there have been people that have abused that protection to keep secrets that should never have been a secret in the first place. And I've seen this because I knew guys that would put alcohol in their safes. So anyway, so like I said, we've got a lot of work to do because we actually have to start cleaning up government. And we have to kind of look at what Madison stated in the Federalist Paper number 10. You know, if government were angels, then or if men were angels, we wouldn't need a government. In other words, if we were acting righteously in everything we did and we couldn't violate the law because we're angels, then we wouldn't need government. But because we're not, then we need government, and we need the men that aren't angels in government, or those people who aren't angels serving in government, to, you know, hold them accountable and to actually have, you know, transparency on everything that they're doing. Again, we do understand the need for national secrets, but we don't want them to abuse the ability of having secrets so that they can go in and talk about how, you know, they're going to do something that is should not be classified and something that they shouldn't even be doing, like what they did in Obamacare, like what they're doing with this infrastructure bill. Some of these things that they're doing with this infrastructure bill, that should have been right out in the open, like this tax that they want to put on every vehicle for 8 cents for every mile that you clock on every vehicle. Then you have to pay 8 cents for every mile you drive every single one of your vehicles. And are you kidding me? The states are trying to do this as well. This is ridiculous. This is ridiculous, and the reason why they're insatiable is because they have no limits of how they can spend your money. Remember that old four ways of spending money Milton Friedman came up with? When it comes to spending other people's money, it is unlimited, and they're ready to spend it all. Every penny that you make, anyway, we'll be right back after these two promos.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcasts and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let's go through the First Amendment, but let me go through the 14th Amendment so that we can delineate what parts of the First Amendment. Actually, we'll go through the First Amendment first, then the 14th Amendment, then we'll kind of pull out those things and then go through these things in detail. So the First Amendment starts off with Congress shall make no law. Now, because we know that the executive and the judiciary are making laws, this really, you have to read this as the federal government shall make no law respecting an establishment, because we've already established that they're legislating, they're violating the Constitution because Congress is no longer the only ones making laws. So we already covered that. So that's why the federal government shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. In other words, they can't get into any form of religious dialogue because by forming a preference towards one thing or a less desirable allowance or a zero allowance for one religion, one faith, or anything like that, like you can't have a Christmas nativity scene, that creates a preference towards something else. What is that other religion? Atheism, possibly. Atheism can become a religion if all of a sudden all other religions can't exist because they cannot make no law respecting an establishment religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So in other words, when it comes to religion, they can't do any type of legislation, can't create any law that steps on anybody's ability of religion at all. They can't tell a school that they can't use the Holy Bible. They can't tell a school that a coach can't pray after a game or before a game with the team. They can't do it. They can't make any law respecting religion. But it's very specific. They can't make a law respecting an establishment of a religion, but in making laws against one religion or another is the same thing as making a law against all religions, which then turns into an atheistic religion. So atheism is actually a religion. Because it is void of all other religions, it becomes the religion of man. It becomes that ideology that we believe that there is no God. Okay, so now it's a belief system. If you understand, if you start putting into context, the antithesis or the void of religion, that in itself is a religion. So in other words, they are making laws of religion. They have made a godless, secular religion that they have been enforcing upon all of us. Every law that they've gone after Christianity and or have shut down the expression of religion because of the following part, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people to peaceably assemble, and to petition the government for the redress of grievances. So now that we've covered, that's the First Amendment. There's a lot of things in there. So let's look at the 14th Amendment really quick, and that little part that actually applies what they call the privileges and immunities, because we saw that in the fourth article of the Constitution, that the privileges and immunities of the different states will be applied to all U.S. citizens. Well, here it is right here. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. So the key part to this is that this is applicable to the rights of the citizens, not organizations, okay? So when it comes down to the establishment of a religion is an organizational structure, not a citizen's right, immunity, or privilege. Doesn't mean that when the state, and actually, if you understand that states have had and have long used religions as a mechanism of providing compassionate services. Back when the 14th Amendment was passed, there were several states that had state-sponsored churches, and the churches were providing compassionate services such as medical care. They were providing welfare. They were providing education. They were providing the majority of the things that the government itself was not to be responsible for. And as a matter of fact, when we went through the cod fishery bounties earlier this summer, we went through this whole point of James Madison using for shock value that if Congress could use their purse, the treasury, for anything that they want, then the next thing you know, they can establish education, they can establish churches, they can establish, and everybody was going, oh my gosh, there was a big gasp in the room. I'm just imagining that that's what happened, because these men understood that they did not want religion to actually, because they all, this was the same time that they passed this First Amendment, that they didn't want the federal government to start mingling into what the states were doing, to establish its own faith, to establish its own welfare system and so forth. So anyway, when we look at the establishment of religion, that part is not actually applied because the states weren't ones to actually provide welfare, health care, and all of these other things. And the question is, do we think it's a good idea for the states to do this, or do we think it's better for a church to do this? Because the states technically start going down this path of becoming anti-Christ, or they become anti-religion as well. They become secular, and that's not right, or even back when they were doing it. This is where we have a big dialogue to actually start having this conversation, because technically a state can actually establish a religion. So I think every state needs to start having this conversation of how is it that they want to administer their compassion services? And this is the beautiful thing about this republic. We can actually have 50 different applications of compassion services between the different states, the hybrids, where the states, you know, grant this to be done by, you know, different religions, and the state grants this to be done by, you know, communities, and the state, you know, takes care of some of it. You know, like maybe elementary school or something like that. And actually, that would be the worst thing for us, right? Anyway, so the establishment of religion is one that's not actually applied to the states, because that is not a privilege or immunity that goes to an individual citizen. But the expression or the free exercising of religion, as they say here, free exercise thereof of religion, then they can't make law. States cannot make a law, and the federal government cannot make a law regarding the expression of religion now because of the 14th Amendment. Prior to the Civil War, states, and before the 14th Amendment, there were plenty of states that were actually restricting the exercise of specific religions, such as Mohammedans and so forth. But now they can't say that you can't exercise that faith. But what they did do was they banned the establishments of certain faiths. In other words, the open practice of Mohammedan. You couldn't have the Jews couldn't have synagogues in many of the churches, and they couldn't go out and actually, you know, talk to people about Judaism and those types of things. They didn't have the ability, not the authority, but they didn't have the ability. And in some states, they had to have a license to actually go out and preach and to teach the gospel or to spread the word and that type of thing in Virginia and other states, because you had to have a license, and you had to get that license from the Anglican Church, because that was the established religion. And the Anglican Church lasted for a long time in Virginia, well past the Constitution. As I point out to people, when Madison wrote his Remonstrance on Religion, when Madison did that, it didn't dismantle the role that the Anglican Church had in the state. It took a while for people to actually start absorbing and understanding, having an open dialogue and moving their way towards being an open and free Christian society and moving away from the Anglican establishment and actually having a, you know, like free competition. In a way, they became a non-denominational state. But they ended up becoming a godless secular state, because that's how all the states ended up, because the federal government started inflicting that upon us starting in the 1900s or the 20th century. Anyway, the abridging of the freedom of speech, in other words, the state government and the federal government cannot make a law regarding, because that's a U.S. citizen's right. But they do have the ability to create laws against speech for public safety purposes. You can't yell fire. You can't yell bomb on an airplane. You can't yell bomb on a, you know, in an airport. Those types of things. It's the same thing with obscenities. They can actually have obscenity laws to say you do not have a right to state this type of thing in front of this age group. Anybody that's under, and this is why we have ratings on R-rated movies, that no one under 17 should be able to go in without a guardian or a parent to allow them. And PG-13, why is it that we have those types of things? Those are based on obscenity standards. And we used to have obscenity laws that you couldn't use certain types of words around children. that does not mean that we're abridging the freedom of speech. That means that we're a disciplined society that believes that children should not be exposed to certain things. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me, AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and their 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so we kind of went through this, and I'm going to go through this a little bit more because I actually point this out. The left and the right, or I should say the conservatives and the communists, or however you want to look at it, everybody from every spectrum of the political ideology, from the white, fully liberty-minded to the black, dark, and when I say, you know, from white to the shades of gray to the absence of white, or light, I should say, because, and I've talked about the scale of liberty. The scale of liberty is a very linear thing that, you know, if you believe in full liberty, that everybody must choose for themselves, and that you cannot compel anybody to do anything, then you believe in, you know, the fullness of liberty, that we have to, full accountability. Doesn't mean we don't have laws. It doesn't mean we can't have laws, but everybody, you know, can do, you know, it's like making cars that will only go 55 miles an hour, you know, so that you put a governor in there so that the throttle is kept and the car is constrained, because I actually have a car that is constrained to 155 miles an hour. There are governors in it that will not allow me to take it over 200 miles an hour, which it is capable of doing. And so, yeah, and so there are, it's just like the Dodge Hellcat. The Hellcat that they made is capable of going well beyond what the manufacturers have put on it because they said it's not safe. Well, that's not what I would consider a true liberty society that is allowing people the full freedom to do those things that, you know, they desire to do and would be held accountable if they were caught violating the law. I mean, what's the difference if somebody is traveling 150 miles an hour or 270 miles an hour on a black, you know, a dark freeway in the middle of Montana or some straightaway out in the middle of nowhere where, you know, they feel like they can do something safe and still break the law, because they're still breaking the law. If you're going 80 miles an hour on, well, actually, there are highways that allow you to go 80. So if you're going 100 miles an hour on any highway in the United States, you're violating the law of the land, and you're going to pay a ticket. But the way that they do these tickets, it's in itself is wrong, because, you know, you have to look at what is the risk. I mean, it's one thing if you're driving 150 miles an hour during rush hour traffic and you cause an accident and kill people because that was absolutely unsafe. But when you calculate for yourself, okay, I got a stretch of road here, I can actually get this thing going, you know, to 300 miles an hour or what have you. And maybe you don't live in Utah where you can actually drive out to the Salt Flats and actually do this, you know, where they can measure you and all of that. Anyway, I'm sorry for going down this tangent, but my point is that we have governors and we have laws and we have the ability to violate the laws because we have liberty. And when you have liberty, that means that you can violate the law. And if you do violate the law, you will, you know, you'll face the consequences. You'll be held accountable and you'll be held responsible as well. Accountable to the law and responsible to society. And, you know, you have to pay your debt to both if necessary. Responsibility, if you cause a person harm, then you'd have to be responsible to that family in, you know, appropriately compensating them for the damages you've done, as well as serving your time in jail to the law. So anyway, when we start looking at the freedom of speech and the freedom of expression, because there's nothing in here other than the, you know, the prohibiting of the free exercise thereof of religion that actually uses the word expression, right? There's expression's not in here, but we use the word expression as like a synonym, and now all of a sudden an expression can be your painting, and your painting can be very graphic, it can be very obscene. And so we do have, and we live in a society, these men who wrote this amendment had a society that made prostitution illegal. They made, you know, obscenities illegal, and you went to jail for that. Well, all of a sudden, even though there's been no change to the First Amendment, it's okay to be obscene. It's actually okay to expose kids, and this is what I was starting off with in this segment, that we all agree, every person agrees, that children at a very young age are very impressionable. That the information that they receive at age 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 and up should be constrained to things that are appropriate for that child's age and comprehension. Well, the left knew this, and I exposed this in my book, because when the left started fighting and they started going after religious expressions that were in the schools, because here were teachers actually saying, hey, the left is too impressionable. We don't want that dogma being driven into these kids' heads. Now that was back in the early 2000s. And let's turn the tables now and let's look at today. Look at the crap that they're putting into these kids' heads with transvestite readings and these sexual morphisms. And so, and I'm going, are you kidding me? We went from a time where they didn't want us to actually, you know, impress kids with the dogma of righteous living. But now it's okay to expose kids to every debased idea and every perversion of sexual perversion known to man, so that these kids can choose their appropriate sexual identity. And I've talked about this. The reason they do this is so that they can ensure that that child's choice is protected from their parents for the rest of their lives. In other words, they want to lock these kids into a life and a living of a bad decision that a poor child made because they were unable to make that decision when they have no understanding, no wisdom to making these decisions. This is how everybody that has any moral conscience looks at America today and looks at our society throughout the world and says, there's no doubt in my mind that our Creator is just absolutely disgusted in how we have debased ourselves, the debauchery that we are living in, the debauchery of the society we have created. These are things that are absolutely have no place within education. And 20, 30, 40 years ago, anybody that would be exposing a child, they would be considered a child molester or something even worse. So how is it that we've changed? Well, because people have said, oh, well, we have these rights of freedom of expression, and it applies to everybody. Now there's no age limits or anything else that we can expose everybody to anything and everything. No, that was never the intent. The intent was that we had a liberal society, but we still had laws, and you were accountable to those laws. And it was up to the people to make it so that prostitution would be illegal. There are places in America where the people have voted to allow prostitution, such as Nevada. Not in Las Vegas. I think the state of Nevada said you had to be a population under a certain amount to make sure that Las Vegas was not, because there were so many people going there, and it's not like you can't find a prostitute. It's just illegal. You choose to break the law, you will be held accountable and responsible. That is a land of liberty where, you know, you have the ability to violate the law, whether it be speeding or whether it be engaging in prostitution. But you still have to face the consequences, and you actually to the law, and you have to be responsible to those that you possibly harm. Anyway, so this freedom of abridging the freedom of speech, and I want to hold on to this abridging, goes into the next and the next and the next. So, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Now, so we can't be making laws, or we can't be holding people accountable of the press, but actually we can, because the press is an institution. The press is a platform, right? When we talk about the press, are we talking about the newspaper, or are we talking about the reporter? Because the reporter typically, you know, has access to be able to, you know, write and or print and or provide something. Now, when we talk about the freedom of the press, is that the newspaper, where the newspaper gets the freedom? Or is it the person that is getting the story that has the protection? So the freedom of the press really should be applied to the individuals that are writing the stories. The press themselves, the platform themselves, should be held accountable and can be regulated, especially if there is stories or other views that can be applied. In other words, is a platform truly an open and objective platform like Facebook, like your local newspaper? Are they only running stories to suit an agenda? Then the platform itself is an agenda-driving platform, because they're silencing and stifling and restraining the ability of the press to be able to, the person, to, like a conservative view, to even reach the readers. It's censorship. And this is where states actually can, because the platform itself is not an individual or a U.S. citizen. It is an institution. So this is where the states can actually do this. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.